Hurricane Ida just plowed through the energy capital of the United States. Today on Parts Per Billion, we look at what this means for the petroleum industry along the Gulf Coast, and also for the millions of people in the region right now without electricity. Hello and welcome back once again to Parts Per Billion, the environmental podcast from Bloomberg Law. I'm your host, David Schultz. Hurricane Ida made landfall this weekend southwest of New Orleans, bringing with it winds in excess of 70 miles per hour and around a dozen and a half inches of rain. This part of the country is the beating heart of the country's petroleum industry. It's where most of the crude oil in the country goes to get turned into, well, not crude things, of which you'll hear about in just a minute. So what happens when an area that's crucial to the country's energy industry gets a direct hit from a hurricane? And also, what's happening to the people who live in the region and, as of the recording of this podcast on Wednesday afternoon, have more immediate energy needs, i.e. just getting the power restored to their homes and businesses? To find out, we're going to hear from two Bloomberg News Energy reporters. In a bit, Josh Saul will tell us about the state of the power grid along the Gulf Coast. But first, we're going to hear from Kevin Crowley, a Bloomberg reporter based in Houston. He's been reporting on how the hurricane is affecting the Gulf Coast industrial energy infrastructure, and there's a lot of it. He started off by talking about petrochemicals and explaining just how much of this industry is concentrated in this small area.
Petrochemicals has actually become a big export business for the U.S. in the last 10 years or so due to the shale boom. Petrochemicals generally take in natural gas liquids like ethane, and they produce chemicals that become the feedstocks for plastics that we see in everyday consumer goods and packaging.
I see. So these are probably chemicals that most consumers wouldn't recognize, but they're chemicals that go into the plastics that we all use every day.
That's right. Polyethylene, polypropylene, they're using everything from shampoo bottles to water pipes to car seats, chlorine. PVC is a big one. The US has become a big exporter of PVC, which is used in window frames. It's used in water pipes. So it's a big material in house building, which has obviously been in huge demand this year as the housing sector has really taken off. And analysts we spoke to said it's that chlorine and PVC manufacturing that was really in the storm's path here. So when we do the market reaction in the coming days, we're likely to see it in those markets, chlorine and PVC. There had also been actually a shortage of chlorine this summer for swimming pools. We're likely to see those shortages exacerbated due to the storm.
Mm, wow. So, you know, a lot of these chemicals are either somewhat hazardous or very hazardous, on their own, and would be not good if they got out into the water or into the air. What are these plants doing to make sure that, you know, when this storm came through, that it didn't cause any emissions that could be dangerous?
So when the storm is coming, the operators tend to wait until they know for certain the storm's path. You know, a small wobble in the direction can make a huge difference to whether they're going to be affected or not. But once they know that they're going to be in the storm's path, generally they shut things down. Shutting down these big refineries and petrochemical plants is no easy task. You know, they operate at enormously high pressure because these are facilities which basically break down hydrocarbons into more useful products. They operate at extremely high pressure. So it's very important to reduce that pressure so that if they do get a direct hit, we don't have a huge explosions. To do that, though, does require them to release a lot of gas in particular. So there's a lot of flaring and there's a lot of emissions each time you shut one of these plants, and then also when you start them up again. So inevitably, there will be huge emissions into the atmosphere. They tend to try and do this in a safe way through flaring, which means you're burning off as much of the gases as you can, as opposed to just simply releasing them. But there is a big environmental impact. What has happened in the past is that when there's been flooding, sometimes you have had uncontrolled leaks, like during Hurricane Harvey, and those can be extremely dangerous to the surrounding communities and the environment.
Right. Well, let's talk about Hurricane Harvey here. You know, there was an uncontrolled leak, as you mentioned, at an Arkema plant in Texas where Hurricane Harvey hit 4 years ago. Are we hearing any indications that we're at risk for that in the Louisiana area, or that something like that is already happened or is underway?
So thankfully not. We haven't heard any reports of any leaks so far. And primarily, it seems to be more of a wind event than a flooding event, which is better, really. So far, anyway, and it's still very, very early days. We're not seeing any examples of major leaks at this point. We'll say though, one major refinery and petrochemical plant that has sustained damage is Shell's Norco operations, which is just outside New Orleans. Pictures have shown pools of standing water and substantial releases of black-colored smoke from its flare stacks, and they have confirmed that. Into some damage, and they have not given a time frame for a restart. But certainly, we're not hearing any reports of any major environmental disasters as we've seen in the past.
Well, that's good, but we should, you know, sounds like we should keep an eye on that Shell plant. Let's also move to the oil and gas industry because petrochemicals aren't the only things that are manufactured in this area. We also have oil refining, which is, you know, taking crude oil and turning it into fuel. And we also have a lot of pipelines which send that fuel to where it's needed. How is that holding up?
So about 10% of the country's refining capacity was in the path of the storm and shut down preemptively. Now the operators are assessing the damage and wondering when to restart. There's been Port Fourchon, which is it's an onshore base that services oil and gas production in the Gulf of Mexico. That was just right on the coast, and that basically took a direct hit. There's been severe damage there that's going to take weeks to recover. And there's also the Louisiana offshore oil port, which receives crude in from the Gulf of Mexico, handles about 15% of the country's crude. That's also in the same areas.
And finally, let's sort of step back from the very, very immediate term and talk about the long term. You know, as we pretty much all know at this point, due to climate change, hurricanes are going to become more powerful. Is there talk of making the oil and gas industry in this area more resilient to withstand those more powerful hurricanes, or, you know, maybe changing the procedures for shutting down to make it, you know, less difficult to shut down when a plant or a factory needs to?
It's certainly top of mind of everyone who works in the industry across the Gulf Coast, both Texas and Louisiana. I mean, every summer. I mean, hurricane season is nearly half the year these days. So it's certainly something that people think about a lot. Certainly, new facilities that are being built, like new oil platforms in the Gulf of Mexico. New expansions to refineries, new infrastructure around. It's much, much easier to build that kind of resilience to storms into the plans when you're building new infrastructure. Older infrastructure, it's much more costly and difficult to update. So there's always that issue. At what cost? But certainly over the last 5 years or so, the industry has become extremely well practiced in evacuations and shutdowns.
I was going to say that's kind of a glass half full way of putting it, that they are very good at evacuations and emergency procedures.
Exactly, yeah, and especially with the offshore platforms where these things are sitting ducks. Really, the oil operators tell us that early decision making is critical. They evacuate all non-essential personnel kind of as quickly as possible when they know it's going to be in the storm's path, to make sure that the people are safe. And thankfully, we haven't heard any reports of any deaths from workers for at least as long as I've been covering the industry here. So they've certainly become well practiced and good at looking after people for sure.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
That was Bloomberg News' Kevin Crowley speaking to us from Houston, Texas. Now we turn to Josh Saul, a reporter who covers climate and natural disasters from New York. Josh talked about the situation on the ground right now.
Hurricane Ida did a real number on the region. We have about just over a million customers without power. And one thing to remember is that customer means just a home or a business. So, you know, if you imagine a family of four, the actual number of people who are sweating in the dark heat right now, it's a lot higher than a million.
Yeah. And is this comparable to other hurricanes that have come through this area, either, you know, Katrina or, you know, hurricanes that have happened since then?
One thing I've learned is that every hurricane is different. So while Hurricane Katrina was extremely damaging and deadly with around 1,800 people losing their lives, Hurricane Katrina was really all about the storm surge and the way that the levees failed in New Orleans. That's why Hurricane Katrina was so bad. Hurricane Ida is different because the levees held up pretty well, held up really well. Hurricane Ida is really more about the wind and the huge number of power lines that have been damaged and thrown down. Some numbers to try to get a sense for how bad the electrical grid was damaged. Hurricane Ida took down more than 2,000 miles of transmission lines owned by Entergy Corp, which is the big utility in the region. Entergy also said the storm in Louisiana and Mississippi damaged or destroyed close to 2,500 power poles, 550 transformers, and almost 3,000 spans of wire. So that's just a huge amount of electrical infrastructure that's had trees tossed into it or that's been flooded with water and shorted out. That all has to be, you know, walked by electrical workers, assessed by electrical workers, and then eventually fixed.
Yeah, and we'll get to the, you know, sort of painstaking work of doing that in a second. But, you know, first I wanted to ask you about the preparations. You know, is there actually anything that a company like Entergy or any electric utility can do when a hurricane is coming toward them to prepare for this, to at least mitigate some of the damage?
Well, having a good levee system, which New Orleans does now, apparently, is a big thing, because having, you know, passable roads and having the majority of your homes not flooded makes the repair process a lot better. But as far as the actual power lines, the technology we have for transporting, you know, power, you know, from a power plant to your house and your air conditioner and your iPhone, we mostly string those up in the air. You know, the power lines you notice when you drive along a road, bearing power lines is a good defense against high winds and falling trees, but it's really expensive. You know, as one of my colleagues has been reporting, it costs about six times as much as having the power lines strung between poles. And also, bearing power lines is not a very good fit for the topography in the Gulf Coast. You know, if you have so much of the region is below sea level, utilities don't like it if their power lines get flooded. Entergy's head of utility operations told my colleague, Will Wade, we learned in grade school that electricity and water don't mix. And he said that New Orleans is below sea level. We bury our dead above ground for that reason.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about how long it'll take to restore power to the region. You reported recently, and actually this was something that surprised me, that the governor of Louisiana, John Bel Edwards, said it's possible that it could take a month to get power back to everyone. That seems like a long, long time.
Slight clarification there. A reporter asked about a month, and then he said, we are really not satisfied with a month. So he wasn't giving that as an estimate. He was kind of responding to that idea.
But I see.
That said, Entergy has said it could take weeks to restore power to certain areas, especially certain hard hit or remote areas. And when you start talking about weeks, a month isn't that far off. So yes, there certainly are going to be a lot of people that are going to be without power for a long period of time. Now, there was some power restored to a relatively small part of New Orleans last night, Tuesday night, but there's still a lot of people without power. And it's very difficult to restore power. Some electrical workers I've talked to talked about in past hurricanes, sometimes, you know, it would take a whole day to, clear the trees and restore power to just one remote home. You know, if a remote home has power lines, you know, running through the trees to get to it, and they have to use swamp buggies or, you know, dig holes by hand in order to redig a hole in the middle of the woods, that can take a whole day, and then it's just one house gets its power back. So it's a pretty difficult task.
Yeah, and it's also worth noting that maybe in some parts of the country, let's say New England or something, you know, the leaves are getting ready to change, but in New Orleans, it is still very much summer. It is hot there, and being without power at a time like this is seems pretty uncomfortable, if not outright dangerous.
Yes, definitely. The governor said yesterday that he's worried, and he said that the response and the recovery can actually be more dangerous than the storm itself. You know, he's talked about people, trying to drive through floodwaters. People are on their roofs trying to clear debris. People are using power equipment they're not used to. Generators can be dangerous if people try to use them indoors. People don't have power for air conditioning or to run their medical devices. He says he expects the death toll to grow and that it's a big concern of his. So yes, definitely not having power is not just uncomfortable, but can also be dangerous.
And let's talk about what it actually takes to restore power. You had a really interesting interview with an official at the Electrical Workers Union down there. And it sounds like this is a pretty manual labor type of process. There's not really a way to automate this. It sounds like very, very painstaking, right?
Yes, it can be, you have to walk the system pole by pole to check all of it. And turning power back on can be a house by house process, because you don't turn power back on to a house if that house is flooded or if that house has trees leaning into it. So it can be it can be a very slow and painstaking process. You also have to bring in all your new equipment. You know, if you have four poles down on a specific line, you have to bring four poles with you to replace those. Head of utility for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the union that represents those workers, he said, it's really difficult, especially when you're talking about setting those poles up when the floodwaters are still up.
Yeah, yeah. And finally, let's talk about the longer term here. As you just mentioned, burying power lines, maybe not really an option in this part of the country. Is there any discussion, though, of ways to make the power grid in the Gulf Coast more resilient, or at least, better able to withstand sort of more powerful hurricanes, which, as we all know, I think are an inevitability in a world with climate change?
Right now, the focus is just on recovery and trying to get power to the people who need it. But I would say that definitely in the weeks and months to come, there will be a lot of discussion about how we can prepare the electrical grid for coming storms. And the same way that after Katrina, so much money, over $14 billion was put into making the levee system better, it could be that after this storm, resources are devoted to hardening the electrical grid.
Yeah, and I guess end on an optimistic note, it sounds like that was money well spent, the money that went into the levees, because this seems like, all the headlines I'm seeing are that this was its first major test since Katrina, and it passed that test.
Yeah, I would agree. A Louisiana State University professor, an expert in civil engineering who I interviewed, said that the levee system in his book did great. He would give it an A grade. But he also said the electrical system would get a much, much lower mark for its performance.
That was Josh Saul, a Bloomberg News reporter, and before that you heard Bloomberg News' Kevin Crowley. And that's it for today's episode of Parts Per Billion. If you want more environmental news, check us out on Twitter. We use a pretty easy to remember handle. It's @environment. Just that, @environment. And I, of course, am @DavidBSchultz. That's B as in billion. Today's episode of Parts Per Billion was produced by myself, David Schultz. Parts Per Billion was created by Jessica Coombs and Rachel Daigle and is edited by Rebecca Baker and Chuck McCutcheon. And our executive producer is Josh Block. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
You don't need to be a judge to be interested in our nation's laws and legal institutions. Just like you don't need to have a law degree to be curious about the inner workings of courts, law firms, and law schools. That's where we come in. My name's Adam Allington, and I'm the host of Uncommon Law, a podcast from the Bloomberg Industry Group. Uncommon Law is where public policy, storytelling, and the law are combined. We explore big topics ranging from tech policy to free speech to race and gender diversity. So please give us a listen. You can subscribe and download today. Just search for Uncommon Law wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much.